open up the Senate Committee on Business Consumer Affairs.
We'll do 957.
Yeah, that's good.
Okay, where's Senator Shields?
Okay, welcome
to the public hearing on Senate Bill 850, 851, and 284. Mr. Krueger.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
How are you doing, sir?
Welcome, Brad. My name is James Krueger. I'm the program manager for the Consumer Finance Program, which is located within the Department of Consumer and Business Services in the Division of Finance and Corporate Security. My purpose being here today is to provide you with a little bit of information and background on this program. Currently, the department has licensed a total of about 350 licensees. Of that number, 108 are payday loan locations owned by 20 different companies. In 1998, those companies made 109,174 loans, totaling $17,628,000. We have licensed 17 title lenders locations owned by 3 companies. In addition, we have licensed 26 locations which make both payday and title loans. Between April 1 of 1998, when the first title lender was licensed, and March 31 of this year, there were 14,593 title loans made for a total of $5,535,000. Currently, persons who lend money under $50,000 at interest rates in excess of the Chapter 82, the interest rate law limitation, which is currently about 12%, are regulated under the Consumer Finance Act program. There has been a growth in high interest rate short-term and single payment loans recently. As I pointed out earlier, April 1 of last year was the first title loan license that was issued. Because this type of lending is relatively new and differs from conventional consumer finance lending, we sought legislation which would define a new license category and incorporate some restrictions in the law which currently are mandated by department policy. In order to address the issues under current law, we have begun administrative rulemaking. In addition to our desire to do that, we received a petition from one of our licensed title loan companies to promulgate administrative rules. On April 1st, we distributed a packet which included a copy of the petition for rulemaking which we received, rough drafts of proposed rules, and an invitation to join a working group to draft rules which would be published for public comment. The packet was distributed to representatives of title, payday, and conventional consumer finance companies, as well as to their lobbyists and to several members of the legislature who had expressed an interest in this type of lending. The draft rules proposed to define a separate license for persons who make high interest rate, short-term, single-payment loans. We believe that creating a new license category will enable the department to more directly address administrative rules to that type of lending without impacting other types of consumer finance lending. And in addition, the department believes that a separate license category may assist consumers in distinguishing the higher interest rate lending from lower interest rate lenders who lend for longer periods of time with terms which require periodic payments rather than a single payment. The draft rules propose to incorporate into the rules some special requirements currently mandated by policy. They include terms and conditions on the repossession and sale of vehicles, the manner in which interest is calculated, and additional disclosures about the high interest rate nature of the loan. We also currently require licensees to treat all extensions of loans as a deferral and prohibit them from treating them as new loans. All of those things are currently imposed by policy, and according to our examination of operations, the license locations have complied with those conditions. The proposed rule also defines a payday title and short-term personal loan, and would require additional conditions not currently imposed by law, rule, or policy. Some of those new proposed conditions include prohibiting a licensee from estimating prejudgment interest when filing litigation to collect funds. We propose to prohibit compounding of interest or charging a prepayment penalty. We propose to prohibit a licensee from charging more than one bad check charge regardless of the number of checks they receive for a single loan, and most license locations follow that policy at the present time. The proposed rule requires the licensee to consider the consumer's ability to repay the loan within the period of the loan and prohibits making loans based solely on the value of the asset securing the loan. The proposed rules would limit the storage charges for repossessed vehicles to 1 month regardless of how long the car was held before sale. And in addition, the proposed rules require that if a loan is extended or deferred more than 3 times, the principal amount must be reduced by 10% at each subsequent deferral. If a borrower is unable to pay the principal down, the lender will be required to write it off. Finally, Mr. Chairman, we expect to schedule a meeting with the work groups, and there are about 18 different people that we have sent this packet to, by mid-May. Our objective is to reach agreement among the work group, publish the proposed rules for comment by the 1st of July. I'd be available to answer any questions if you have them.
Questions? Yeah, I think that's the direction we're going to go. We're going to create this work group. Senator Shields is going to come in and testify, and if he comes back in, we'll have give him an opportunity to do that. But we realize that there's an issue here and that we want to give people an opportunity to be heard and have some time to kind of mull this over. So we will close the public hearing on Senate Bills 850, 851, and 284. Okay, we'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 957. Okay, Howard, is it Minion? Maya. Meiser, okay, thank you very much. I guess I looked at that question. I guess I should have done that. Well, welcome, sir, and please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. My name is Howard Meisner. I'm from Grange Co-op in Central Point, Oregon. We operate card locks and retail stores and several other operations in that Southern Oregon area. We've been in the card lock business since 1979, and we've ridden the ups and downs in this, and we probably don't have to plow any ground with most anybody here because you're relatively familiar, I'm sure, with the regulations. Our concern, and it's not just mine or Grange Co-op's concern, it's the card lock operators pretty much throughout the state are restricted, as you know, in who can use a card lock by several factors, one being a gallonage factor of 2,400 gallons, and the other one is that you're a business of some type. I don't think that many of us have a problem with you being a business to use a card lock, but the 2,400 gallons is really shackles around our legs and small business. You have a session out here in the lobby right now about small business. Small business makes up a tremendous portion of Oregon's economy, as you well know. But yet the card lock issue, as it is written today, the regulations prohibit small business from using and benefiting from a card lock for dispensing of gasoline. And that prohibit is imposed by that 2,400 gallons. As we have proposed in Senate Bill 957, it would eliminate completely any gallonage requirement, thus eliminating any discrimination that this gallonage requirement causes or imposes on small business. As you know, if you're a small business and only have one or two vehicles, it's extremely difficult to meet this gallonage requirement. Hence, you can't use a card lock and receive the benefits that that card locks have available to businesses. Again, we have no objections to the licensing factor. The second point that we would like to make and see taken out of here, changed as we have in our proposal, is the $5 fee per account that card locks must pay the Oregon State Fire Marshal's office. That fee was written in there in 1991 to offset what they thought would be the cost of monitoring or auditing card locks operations. to exemplify that fee, we sent the Oregon State Fire Marshal's office almost a few dollars short of $7,000 last year so that we could be in business. Now, that $7,000 was to audit our accounts. Now, maybe they do have some very expensive employees. I don't know. But I cannot fathom how they could use that $7,000 to audit our account. And when you take into consideration that there's about, give or take, 500 card locks throughout the state, 400 to 500, and it's kind of a figure that you really can't get a handle on, that is a tremendous amount of money that is poured into the Oregon State Fire Marshal's office. We also, above that $5 fee per account, we pay another $250 fee per site. In our mind, that $250 per site is more than adequate to audit our accounts with. If you take the gallonage requirement out of this, then we don't have to go through all of the expense to dig up and maintain and keep gallonage for foreign customers coming in to use our system, as we are mandated to do now by the State Fire Marshal's Office due to the old regulations. That auditing fee or demand on the State Fire Marshal's Office would be reduced dramatically if all they had to do was to check to make sure that we were servicing only businesses. And the same verification that was written up in 1991 is still applicable. A federal ID number, a business license, tax form, anything like that that verifies you're either a foreign government or a business. That's very workable. That would be very easy to audit, and that could be financed with that $250 per site that we pay. When you multiply that out, $250 per site times 400 to 500 card locks in the state of Oregon, they're still getting a tremendous amount of money to finance their operations. Okay? That is the two main key factors that our proposal has done. Again, just to quickly summarize, that is to eliminate completely any gallonage requirement attached to the card lock regulations. Secondly, eliminate the $5 fee completely that is paid to the Oregon State Fire Marshal's Office for auditing. A very slight change in the owned and used by the non-retail customer. So that is just kind of a little housekeeping.
Thank you, sir. Questions? Thank you very much. Senator Hannon was going to be here, but we got out of the session late, and so he said he might be some late. Because we'll close the public hearing. Well, no, so we have some more testimony here. So if he has an opportunity to come in, we'll give him an opportunity to speak. Thank you very much, sir. Appreciate your coming up. Mike Sherlock, well, just a second. Before we do that, we'll temporarily close the public hearing here and open up the public hearing 850, 851, and 284, and Senator Shields. Welcome, sir, after our hectic session on the floor today. Thank you for coming, and please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Senator Frank Shields, Senate District 9. I want to apologize for being late. I got mugged when I was coming off the floor, and you can understand that, given the session we had this morning. I'd like to begin by thanking Mr. Chair for hearing these bills. I believe that it is a very important issue, and it definitely needs to be addressed before the session ends. There's a great deal of information that I could give you in the testimony this morning, but I'm giving you instead some written material, which you can review on your own time. I have distributed a study that was written by the Graduate School of Management at Willamette University, the Atkinson School. In this study, they detail the growth and the impact of the car title loan industry in Oregon, and they detail a variety of possible approaches to solving the problem. Hope to take a look at that. While this study was completed at the beginning of session, it is somewhat dated, and I say that only because of the huge number of car title loan and payday loan operations that open weekly. While it might be somewhat dated, it does identify seven alternatives. But the action that it ultimately recommends is incorporating car title loans into the Pawnbrokers Act. That's the reason I brought Senate Bill 850. Of course, 851 has a different approach. there are a number, and I need to say this, there were a number of victims of this industry who had originally hoped to have the opportunity to speak to you today. And I hope at some point in the future they'll have a chance to do that. But since they couldn't speak about the problems they've faced, I just submit this information to you. The car title loan business started in April of 1998. Typically, these operations offer a 30-day loan. They'll give you up to 20% of the value of your vehicle. Now, some of you might have $50,000 vehicles, but usually for these people, they're vehicles that are $5,000 or less. So you can maybe get up to $1,000, 20%. 30 days, the annual percentage rate of interest is 300%. The borrower must repay the interest on the loan or repay the entire loan, or the lender can repossess the vehicle. The reasons that the title loans are a problem relative to most other loans is twofold. First off, they have a very high interest rate. That's obvious, 300%. But more importantly, the collateral that they require is worth a great number of times more than the value of what people are getting. Even a payday loan, you don't have to risk as much money as you risk when you risk your car. In car title loans, when a person defaults, they lose 5-10 times as much money as they borrowed. I believe that the number of people who might default on these loans is higher than it needs to be. I feel that if it weren't so high, I wouldn't object so much. But statistics that are even now beginning to be developed tell us that people are far more likely to default on this kind of loan than on a conventional loan because there's no background check done. If you go to a bank and you apply for a loan, they at least try to figure out through checking your credit history and so on if you're likely to be able to pay the loan back. But these folks don't do that kind of thing. They advertise a 15-minute process. You don't really reasonably get to check people out and find out if they can really pay loans back at that speed. The car title loan industry, I don't think, really cares whether you can repay the loan. In fact, they want to roll over that loan again and again because you can make more money on it. Some of these people will actually say to you, in defense of the industry, that it's a niche market. And I would suggest to you, if it's a niche market, that the niche that car title loan people go after is the elderly, the poor, and minorities. Take a look at where these institutions often set up. They are in the lowest income parts of my district in Southeast Portland and so on. I understand that the committee has some concerns and reservations about these bills. I agree that there's more work that needs to be done before any of these bills are ready to be voted on. It is my hope that you will permit us to form a work group to create a bill that makes some sense and that brings some regulation to this industry. I'm aware many members of the legislature don't want to reopen the discussion of limiting interest rates. I know the banking industry isn't interested in that, but I think that we can bring all interested parties together and work on this and come back in a very short period of time. I've kind of chopped up my testimony jumping from here to there. Sorry about the speed with which we've had to do things, but I hope that you'll consider work session or a work group that I'd be glad to work with and come back to you.
Mr. Kruger testified before you, and so that was the direction for him to get together with you folks and all the parties and try and come up with some sort of agreement.
Okay. I'd like to say that I did talk to Mr. Kruger in the hall, and we agreed to get together at 1 o'clock on Friday afternoon, if that's okay with you.
That's okay. Fine with me.
And we're going to meet in the house side. Probably up on the fourth floor in the conference room. Okay. I just say that in case there's people here that want to be there.
I love that, and we better say that again.
Okay, 1 o'clock Friday, upstairs on the fourth floor in the conference room on the house side.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator. Appreciate it. Close public hearing on those three bills, 850, 851, and 284. Reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 957. We have Mike Sherlock, Carol Washburn, and Rob Douglas. Welcome. I hesitate to limit your time, but we do have some other bills going on, so we can limit you to, about 3 or 4 minutes per person. We'll give us a brief overview, and if you've got some handout materials, and the committee would stay open, so if you have written materials, we would, for public input, we'd keep that open for you.
Okay, thank you. My name is Mike Sherlock. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Gasoline Dealers Association. What we're really talking about here is our good old friend self-service. And we kind of talk around it when we talk about the card lock rules, but I just want to kind of make sure everybody really understands what the issue is. The Oregon Gasoline Dealers Association, as a matter of policy, opposes any liberalization of current laws, rules, and or regulations governing the use of non-retail card lock facilities in the state. Consequently, the OGDA opposes Senate Bill 957, which proposes to loosen the number of eligibility requirements for non-retail card lock use, most prominently by eliminating the minimum annual purchase required, 2,400 gallons, and the vehicle ownership requirement. In addition, the OGDA is concerned that eliminating the $5 annual non-retail customer fees could be a detriment to the state fire marshal card lock enforcement program. In the 1991 legislative session, card lock operators and retail operators agreed to a compromise allowing for some leeway in the non-retail dispensing sectors. That compromise and leeway are reflected in the current statutes and rules governing card lock use. The OGDA is concerned that reopening the issue via Senate Bill 957 would reopen the subject of retail, non-retail, attended, unattended, and other matters, self-serve, related to gasoline dispensing. This is an issue the OGDA wishes not to pursue or argue in 1999. We feel that the passage of Senate Bill 957 would create an even greater inequity between unstaffed, non-retail card lock facilities and the retail facilities at which attendants must be on duty. A couple of additional points I just want to point out. With the liberalization of these rules that we're talking about, the biggest area that will be affected are going to be the small urban or small small rural dealers who are barely hanging on right now with all the tank regulations and all those things that you guys are aware of. If the additional gasoline is sold at these card locks as being proposed, that will be the death knell for a number of small rural dealers. It's a serious issue in the rural areas for the gasoline dealers. The other thing is, I just want to, you know, talk about the self-service part of it. In 1991, what had been proposed was that there would be an outright ban on self-service anywhere in the state. Obviously, some of the existing card lock facilities didn't approve of that. They didn't think that was a good idea. And so we worked for a good while in that session and finally came to this compromise, which allows the total or the use of real commercial operators to be able to serve themselves, but leave the real true retail part of it with the retail dealers. And we really resent the fact that this is even being brought up since we came to that compromise in 1991. So thank you for answering
the
question.
Thank you very much. We'll go to the panel. Carol?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Carol Worsher, and I'm the Compliance Service Manager with the State Fire Marshal's Office, and our the Card Lock Union is responsible for enforcing the laws of the non-retail field of dispensing in Oregon. Senate Bill 957 eliminates the requirements for non-retail customers to purchase 24 gallons of fuel per year. It also allows the non-retail customers to dispense fuel into motor vehicles owned by the non-retail customer if used in a business. It also eliminates the $5 annual fee for non-retail customers. This bill allows a decrease in the numbers of gallons of fuel a customer spends annually qualifies as a card lock customer right now. The decrease in the gallons requirement will increase the number of customers that would be served at the card lock facility. Just to let you know, in 1991, when we started, there was approximately 65,000 customers that were reported to us. For 1999, there was approximately 39,841 customers that the card lock operators have reported to us at this time. By decreasing accounting requirements, the number of customer accounts per facility will increase. This will increase the number of customer accounts per facility that must be audited by the Oregon State Fire Marshal. This bill also allows non-retail customers to dispense fuel into motor vehicles owned and used by a non-retail customer if used in the business. This change would allow business owners and employees to fuel their personal vehicle at a car lot facility as long as the fuel is used for business purposes. This change would increase the documentation that would be required for us and also for the car lot operators out there to have on file, that each customer would, that in order to guarantee that the customers would use it for business purposes only. There would be additional complaints at this time because of the personal use of the personal vehicles that would be there, even though the employees are certified that they were using it for business purposes only. This would perceive the sales services being allowed. However, it is anticipated that there would be additional complaints investigated, additional record keeping, increasing auditing time at each facility to be able to do this. That would increase a workload issue, and we would need additional FTEs to complete that audit at this time. With the decrease, with eliminating the $5 customer fee, the license fee would have to be increased in order to offset that. As of now, the $5 customer fee would show a deficit in the budget for the car lock unit, $397,870 per biennium. Currently, right now, the car lock operators are able to, they charge that $5 fee out to individual customers, and then they pass that fee on to the state fire marshal's office. To provide the current level of service, again, if we eliminate the $5 customer fee, we would need to look at the increase in the license fee to cover that cost. If this bill is passed, what we would like to recommend is that due to the workload issue that the state fire marshal be allowed of the additional FTEs. It is recommended consideration be given to continue the requirement that the vehicle be owned and used by the business and that the $5 annual customer fee be continued to provide adequate funding for this program.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Rob Douglas, representing Truax Harris Energy. Truax Harris Energy operates both retail and card lock fueling facilities, and the split between those units is about 50-50. We are here today in opposition to this bill. Prior to the 1991 legislative session, we did not feel there was any clear statutory definition of card lock commercial fueling. We worked very hard during that 1991 session to put ourselves in a position where there would be a statutory definition. It was a session-long negotiation. It was not always easy. There was plenty of disagreement, but we would like to keep faith that 1991 agreement, which was struck between the dealers, between the wholesalers, distributors, and all the parties involved. This 2,400 gallonage requirement that continues to come under attack is not capricious. It's not arbitrary. It's been a subject of court decisions. I believe it's gone all the way up to the state Supreme Court, and it has been upheld. The fire marshal has been sued on this in county court. It went to the Oregon State Court of Appeals, and again, I think went to the Oregon State Supreme Court as well. So we would oppose this legislation.
Any questions? Yes, Senator Byer.
Thank you. Chair, I'm curious if you have you done any preliminary scoping on what it would take in terms of additional FTE and related costs to do the auditing where you'd have to.
At this time, with the numbers that we've come up with, we don't have exact numbers of that. You know that for the additional, the 2,400 gallons is not an issue for us. Because we are aware of in our auditing out there, there are businesses that meet all the requirements except for the 2,400 gallons. And that would increase the customer, but not sufficient enough that we feel that that would be a problem for FTEs at that point for that. For FTEs would be needed to come in to, for our business would be that when you allow the employees to use their personal vehicle to use at a car lock facility, we feel that that would be a lot of complaints and also a lot of documentation that the operators would have to keep on file to make sure that that is only being used for business purposes only, and not for personal use.
Any questions? Senator Miller.
What is it that the car locks get for the $5 charge? What service do you provide?
Mr. Chair and Senator Miller, we go out and we do an audit at each facility for each customer. We verified that they've been into a written agreement, they have been provided safety training, they have documentation filed that they are a business, and that they meet the requirements of purchasing 2,500 gallons. We also do a fire safety inspection of each facility out there to make sure that they meet the requirements of statutes and rules and also the USC codes for the State Fire Marshal's Office. Mm-hmm.
If I might. Have you found they've been pretty much in compliance with your regulations?
I was trying to get this information. I was trying to get this information prior to coming here, and I wasn't able to obtain that at that time. But my recollection of some of the numbers that I've seen this past year that comes through on my desk there is we're probably about 39% in compliance at the time that we do the audit. Out there, we have 39% at the time we do the audit. We our process of how we do that is we go out and do an audit. If we find the company in violation, if there's violations occur, then we give them opportunity time to get their appropriate documentation, information, and then we also do a follow up if we issue penalties out. We do a follow-up audit and start taking inspection if that's required at that time to do that. So we may be out at the company a couple of times a year if that's necessary in order to get them in compliance. At the end of our audit year, which is October 1 to September 30th, we have every company in compliance at that time with that database. But again, we are looking only at 5% of the database.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I just say, Mr. Chairman, you're kind enough to allow me to say more on this particular subject later today. But I just, as long as this panel's here, I just want to express my never-ending gratitude for the job they do in making sure that Oregonians are safe and secure and do not engage in this extraordinarily dangerous activity of filling their own tank. They realize that in the 48 states where it's allowed, it's just incredible accidents taking place, lives are in jeopardy, but we have the fire marshal and we have these people who don't want to allow this freedom, and it's just wonderful to have you here.
Well, Don McCauley, would you like to follow that? Thank you for your testimony. I appreciate it. Welcome, John.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm John McCauley, representing the Agriculture Cooperative Council. I know you've got a big agenda, so I'm going to be very brief. You heard the discussion about the 1991 agreement, quote, being a compromise. And I think it's important to point out that my organization and the folks we represent were not necessarily a part of that compromise. So I guess we are not compelled to restrain ourselves in coming to you to correct what we think was a mistake that was made in 1991, and we don't resent Senator Hannon and the Grange Co-op Supply bringing this bill to you. We think it's entirely appropriate to continue to discuss this policy that's been established by the state of Oregon. And we, too, like Senator Miller, are very thankful for the wonderful service that is provided our members by the State Fire Marshal's Office.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Any further comments? Close public hearing on 957. Open up public hearing on Senate Bill 446 from Senator Miller.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just remain here if you'd like. In recognizing the time frame, let me just say that Senate Bill 446 simply removes the policy statement that prohibits the self-serving dispensing of self-service dispensing of gasoline by our what I deem to be competent citizens. As I said just previously, 48 states allow this activity. I happen to believe Oregonians are absolutely as capable as our residents in the other 48 states that allow this activity. The policy statement that is generated is the product, Mr. Chairman, and I was here, of a pieced-together statement in the wee hours of the 1991 session are based on absolutely no findings by this legislature. They are the ruminations of a legislature who has since departed, and they have no place in our statute. And I have received letters on this bill that suggest that this removes the prohibition on self-service, and I regret that that misinformation has been distributed widely. And I have a feeling I know the source, but that notwithstanding, the prohibition remains. I'm sorry that I can't remove it. I realize the political difficulty that kind of a straightforward approach would have. But this bill does not remove it. It simply gets rid of a meaningless and frankly offensive policy statement. This really demeans, I think, the intelligence of Oregonians. If I might read from this policy statement, this suggests, it says, the Legislative Assembly declares that, for instance, appropriate safety standards often are unenforceable at retail self-service stations in other states because cashiers are often unable to maintain a clear view of and give undivided attention to the dispensing of class one flammable liquids by customers. Well, I suspect that if that was a problem, the other 48 states would not be allowing this supposedly dangerous activity because their cashiers are inside the AM/PM or whatever they're doing, and in fact, if we could get people to travel outside of Oregon on occasion, maybe they'd find out you go to pumps and you simply insert a credit card and you don't even see the cashier, and yet again, I'm just amazing other states allow this activity, Mr. Chairman. It also says higher liability insurance rates charged to retail self-service stations reflect the dangers posed to customers when they leave their vehicles to dispense this gas, including the increased risk of crime. Now, I suspect that those people who are hiding behind the propane tanks, when you go in to pay your bill, in the circumstance that maybe you still do that on some occasions, are waiting to go in and steal everything out of your automobile, take your kids, whatever it is they take, and that is this particular crime problem that Oregonians would suffer from if we allowed this activity. And then it is talked about here, the increased risk of personal injury resulting from slipping on slick surfaces. Boy, I'll tell you, I know that is, as subparagraph 4 says, unique to Oregon in that this is state law. The dangers of crime and slick surfaces described in Section 3 are enhanced because Oregon's weather is uniquely adverse. Now, causing wet pavement and reduced visibility, and it's very difficult to see those pumps when you get out of your car. I know that, Mr. Chairman. But to suggest that our weather here is uniquely adverse is to just apparently not understand the weather in the other 48 that allow self-service. Try selling that to somebody who lives in Washington, Montana, North Dakota, Idaho, any northern state, Michigan, I don't care where you go, any state other than New Jersey where they haven't been bright enough to lift the prohibition, I do. Mr. Chairman, it says, it talks about higher prices charged for full service fuel dispensing in states where self-service is permitted. That falls under the category of duh. If you want service, and we have a lot of people here who provide service today, service costs money, appropriately so. You know, I don't have a beef with that. But clearly, in the other states where self-service is allowed, the price is less. But that notwithstanding is not the reason I do this, Mr. Chairman, and I hope that the committee, and I appreciate your indulgence here because I know your time. This is all about fundamental freedom and respect for our citizens. As I said, this demeans the intelligence of Oregonians. To say that we can't engage in this activity, in my view, prohibits a right of freedom that ought to be granted to our citizens. I may not choose to pump my own. I can find service, as you can in other states. But our current law says you can't do it even though you are absolutely capable, unless perhaps we go to this card block expansion opportunity, which is very attractive to me, and allow citizens to do this if they want to. There is no justification for the state of Oregon saying you can't do it. And the justification now imposed is that some people want to guarantee their service, so they impose this restriction on all of the rest of us. And that, Mr. Chairman, is wrong. That's the end of my sermon. I appreciate it. Thank you much.
Any questions? Just a couple more witnesses, Phyllis Rand and Jim Davis.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you. I'm Phyllis Rand, a member of the Governor's Commission on Senior Services. Senator Miller, I'm sure, was not surprised to see me here. We have been in opposition to self-service gas for many, many years. I had pulled the ORSs from 480315 because I thought that was a piece that I had wished to talk about, but it's been pretty badly ridiculed, so I'm just going to leave it and not bring it up. But I did want to tell you about an article that was in the Sunday Statesman Journal, October 25th, 1998. The Oregon Court of Appeals on Wednesday rejected the latest legal challenge to Oregon's ban on self-service gas stations. Oregon forbids motorists to pump their own gas unless they can qualify as commercial accounts at so-called card lock stations. The Court of Appeals ruled that the statutes do not violate the constitutional equal protection requirements. The court also turned aside other constitutional arguments in the lawsuit brought by several consumers and small gas stations. The state's ban on self-service retail gas stations was passed in 1951 as a safety measure. Oil companies and retailers long have sought to repeal the law. Only Oregon and New Jersey still outlaw retail service gas pumps. The other issue I want to say that is repeatedly the voters have turned down self-service gas, and I think that they have done that for a reason, and we need to be aware of that. This came up very quickly, and so I don't have written testimony, but I will see that you get it.
Okay. Thank you very much. Jim.
Thank you. I'm Jim Davis, representing the Oregon State Council of Senior Citizens, United Seniors of Oregon, Great Panthers, and Advocacy Coalition for Seniors and People with Disabilities. We're also part of a coalition, 1,000,001 Oregonians Against Pumping Gas, that's been strongly opposed to this. And we come to you in strong opposition to 446. Actually, we're a little surprised that it came up, and so we are not here and ready with the troops that we would have been had we been aware of this. But we are aware of this effort to remove this language, and we actually agree with the language. We like the language in statute, and we feel that removing this language would be the first step to implementing a self-service system. It makes it very easy after this language is removed, and a similar bill passed a few years back, a few sessions back, and we were able to organize a campaign that got the governor to veto that piece of legislation. We feel that this is particularly inconvenient and harmful to seniors and people with disabilities, people with physical difficulties, you know, holding the pump and getting gas all over them, having to deal with that. Slipping in this weather is a factor. And crime is a factor in a lot of these areas. The people in the booths cannot adequately see all the pumps around them, and there are potentially crime dangers that are in existence there. But also there's an economic factor, and what we're seeing in other states is the fact that there are substantial increases in the cost of full service when somebody would need help getting a gas pump for them if they are unable to do it themselves. And there's always been a two-tiered system like of this nature, and we're concerned about our seniors and people with disabilities and the economic hardship that this would cause. So we appreciate the chance to come before you today, and we strongly oppose this legislation.
That's your question.
Thank you. Just
concerned you're about ready to shut off the hearing.
Yes,
I just wanted to say one thing. I appreciate that testimony. I continue to invite those who oppose this bill just to read the bill, because it does not end the prohibition. If I wanted to do that, they've included in this language, and frankly, somewhat offended by the theorists out there who think that this is all part of some grand scheme that couldn't happen unless the majority of this legislature agreed with it. And finally, I forgot to insert one more reason why this is such a preposterous notion. It says that the keeping this ban in place increases, or the increase in self-service dispensing decreases the maintenance checks by attendants. Now, I know probably most of you go to places where five or six attendants run out and raise the hood and check all your spark plugs and, you know, change your oil and do all that stuff, but I guess I have frequented those stations lately. So one of the things that has happened with the advent of actually less service, which is as close to self-service as you can get, are the 10-minute oil reads, and probably you are benefited by the current system. Probably a whole lot more maintenance done now than was done 5 or 10 years ago. So, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions?
All right.
Close the public hearing. We'll just open up a work session on that in 446, and see if you're willing to wherever
possible. Yeah, all right, well, I move Senate Bill 446 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Miller moves Senate Bill 446 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any comments? Does anybody wish to be noted as a nay vote on this? Senator Metzger, have the records to show that Senator Meyer and Senator Metzger are nay votes on this, and Senator Starr, Senator Nelson, and Senator Miller are aye votes. 3-2 vote. Motion carries. Senator Miller carried that. She has a front of Mark Arjun. Open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 1282. Excuse me. Work session on Senate Bill 1282.
Mr. Chair, we have a request for the bill, Senate Bill 1282, to be moved to the Transportation Committee, Senate Committee on Transportation, for action. So if the committee members feel that it's appropriate, we need a motion to refer this bill out of committee with no recommendation and onto the Transportation Committee.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I move Senate Bill 1282 to the Committee on Transportation without recommendation.
Okay, any comments, objections, so ordered, and open up a work session on Senate Bill 770.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 770 has been requested to be referred to the Public Affairs Committee. So if the committee members agree, then we need a motion to refer this bill out of committee with no recommendation to Public Affairs.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator
Miller. I move Senate Bill 770 to the Committee on Public Affairs without recommendation.
Senator Miller moves Senate Bill 770 to the Public Affairs Committee without recommendation. Any comment? Objection? So ordered. Now we get down to real business. Open up the public hearing on House Bill 2793. We just thought we were having fun before this, didn't we? I would call Mike McCollum, please.
Right on schedule.
Yeah, and we're right on schedule. The thing is, we're for the benefit of the audience, we only have a two-hour meeting here because we have another committee meeting coming in. And so we have a panel of witnesses here. Probably not everybody's going to get an opportunity to testify because we're short of time. But I want to give everybody an opportunity if possible. And we have a list of people, the experts for and against, and hopefully we'll get a good flavor of what's going on with this bill. So, okay, thank you. So, Mike, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Mike McCollum. I'm the Executive Vice President of the Oregon Restaurant Association, for a trade association that represents approximately 3,300 food and beverage institutions around the state. With me today is Marilee Bossaraba from the Internal Revenue Service and James Turborg, a professor from the University of Oregon. Hospital 2793 does some very simple things. It establishes a tip wage in the state of Oregon, a concept that has been adopted by the federal government since the implementation of the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act. It's also a concept that's in place in 43 other states in the nation. The tip wage that we're proposing would apply two different ways. First, for current employees, we would establish a $6.50 tip wage, exactly the current state's minimum wage. We would apply a tip wage to employees hired after the year 2000 of $5.50. In both these illustrations, we have a threshold of application that says the employee would have to be reporting in tip income and wages combined at least $10 per hour. So, for current employees, they would need to be reporting to their employer $3.50 per hour in tips. For future hires, they would have to be reporting to their employer $4.50 per hour before the tip wage would be established. In the case of current employees, this would only have an impact when future increases in the minimum wage occur. The other part of the bill establishes an opportunity wage for youth, and it simply says that for employees under the age of 18, for the first 60 days of their employment, they could be paid 50 cents less than the state's minimum wage. Compare these provisions to provisions in federal law real quickly. First, the federal tip wage is $2.13. The tip wage we're talking about here, $6.50 for current employees. The federal opportunity wage for youth is 50 cents less, very similar to ours, except theirs applies to employees 21 years of age and under, and it goes for 90 days rather than the 60 days that we propose. Why do we need a tip wage in Oregon? The primary reason this bill's before you today is that we've had a 38% increase in the state's minimum wage in 27 months. And what we have seen is that we have caused displacement in our work environment. And the primary place that occurs is as the wages go up, we're forced to give the increases to the people earning minimum wage. That stops us from having labor dollars available to pass to people who are earning in excess of the minimum wage. Cooks, bus help, support staff, they may be earning 50 cents or a buck above minimum wage now. When we're forced to give tipped employees a 50 cent increase, it takes away our ability to compensate the people working solely for wages. Dr. Kerbor will elaborate on this point. His study indicates that 71% of restaurants in Oregon intend to eliminate jobs in order to accommodate this 38% increase in the minimum wage. This study will also show that 77% of Oregon restaurants are going to cut employees' hours as a result of this dramatic increase in the minimum wage. And the hours that they're most likely to cut are wait staff hours. So, frankly, wait staff are trading a 50 cent increase in the minimum wage for the ability to earn tipped income. It's not a good trade for them. This study will also show that that employee is earning nearly $16 an hour on average in the state of Oregon when you combine his tip income with his wage income. It's not a good trade for the wage staff. He will also point out the displacement that causes to youth employment when employers make a choice. They say, shall we hire more experienced workers or shall we hire first-time workers? And when we have a wage, $6.50, the highest in the nation as our minimum wage, we force employers to look for more experienced help and take away opportunities for youth. Tips are wages. They're wages when employers calculate them, their taxes. They do it for federal unemployment. They do it for state unemployment, Social Security,
workers' compensation. There is a tax credit available for certain taxes at the federal level, none at the state level, no consideration for workers' comp cases. Mr. Bonsaraba will go through many of the reporting requirements, and I've included those things in my packet as well. I won't be redundant in that respect. A couple quick charts, I hope, that tell you why we're here with this issue. Not new news. Federal minimum wage, $5.15. States around the nation, their average minimum wage is $5.24. Oregon's minimum wage, $6.50. Talk about the hourly wage comparison. I told you the major reason we're here is the displacement between front of the house employees and back of the house employees. Average starting wage for non-tipped employees, $6.52. Average high wage for non-tipped employees, $9.52. Average wage for tipped employees, when you include their tips, $15.99. That's the disparity that I'm talking about. We seek to remedy that with a tip wage, and the one that we're seeking is much more moderate than those around the country. You'll see, the federal tip wage established at $2.13. National average tip wages, this is the 43 states, who have adopted the same concept as the Fed. They average $2.89. What we're proposing with this legislation is that we establish a tip wage of $6.50 for current employees, and it only applies when that tipped employee reports to the government $3.50 an hour in tip income, making their earnings $10 an hour. That's what we're asking for. Nearly three times the federal minimum wage for tipped employees, and the only state in the nation that would have a qualifying threshold. The tip wage for future hires, same exact concept, $10 an hour, same principles apply across the board. This would only apply to employees who report to the government $4.50 per hour in tip income. So, doesn't apply to minimally tipped employees in any circumstance, only applies to those who are using substantially tipped employees. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Nelson and our committee members. My name is Marilee Bonsaraba. I'm the tip coordinator with the Internal Revenue Service for the Pacific Northwest District, representing Alaska, Hawaii, Oregon, and Washington. I'm here today invited by the Oregon Restaurant Association to simply give you the facts of what the tip laws are at the federal government level. Briefly, I've given you a packet and a summary, a two-page summary of the exact laws. The laws to the employees are that tipped employees are to keep records of their tips. They're to keep a record of who they tip out to. They're to report to their employers as soon as they receive $20 in a calendar month period, and they have to report by the 10th day of the following month. Tips are reported at 100%, not 8%. The employer's responsibilities are that they're to report the tips reported to them by the employees on their quarterly 941 federal employment tax form as tips on line 6B. They're subject to income tax withholding, Social Security and Medicare taxes, and federal unemployment tax. They're also to report the tips and treat them as wages on the employee's W-2s. Employers are required to keep records of their charge receipts, the tips reported by employees, their gross sales, charge receipts showing tips, and allocated tips. If the employer is a large food and beverage establishment, they're also required to file Form 8027, the employer's annual information return of tip income and allocated tips. In addition, and finally, if the wages payable by the employer, other than tips and other funds, turned over to the employer by the employee are not sufficient to cover the withholding, required tax withholding, on the total wages and tips reported, the employer is required to furnish a written statement to the employee of what taxes are due, tax liability they incur. Several years ago, the IRS identified a noncompliance problem with people reporting tips nationwide. In response to that, They conducted a study to find out exactly how significant the problem was. They identified in 1993 anywhere from $9 billion to $30 billion annually going unreported in tip income. So in response to that, the IRS went to the drawing boards and came up with two educational programs. The first one that came out in 1993 was the Tip Reporting Determination Agreement, TRDA. And that made the employer a policeman and was not well received. So they went back to the drawing boards, and in 1995 they came out with the TRAC, or Tip Reporting Alternative Commitment Program. And that's what I'm here to talk a little bit about right now. It's an education outreach program. It's very positive and forward-thinking. The employer agrees to do three things. They agree to maintain and establish, first of all, an education program quarterly for their newly hired employees and the existing employees. And it can be a very simple education program, as much as a flyer or their paycheck, reminding them of the TIP laws. Second, they agree to establish a procedure for monitoring and capturing the data that they need. Some of those requirements are already in place, so it's not a new requirement for the employer to capture gross sales and cash tips and charge tips. And thirdly, they agree to comply with all federal tax requirements regarding the filing returns, paying and depositing taxes, and maintaining records. For the periods during which the agreement is in effect, the IRS then agrees not to do a TIP audit. The results of the TRAC program have been very successful so far. There were three things we looked at. We looked at increasing filing for Forms 8027, the TIP allocation information return that we require from large food and beverage establishments. That increased nationwide up to 20% in the last year, up to 58,000 of a possible population of about 100,000 that would be required to file that form. Also, the increased TIPs being reported nationwide, a 28% increase in TIPs being reported between 1994 and 1997, up $2.36 billion to $10.8 billion. In Oregon, between 1996 and 97, we have a 44% increase in TIPs being reported, $20 million increase from 1996 to 1997 for a total TIPs of being reported in 1997 of $65.2 million.
Yes. Do you have any data on what percentage was tipped out by white people to other folks in Russia?
I don't have that.
Do you know what the industry
we have? No, I do not. I don't have that information.
Do you have an average of tip rate base?
No, because we don't ask for that information. The Form 8027 gives us total tips for the establishment, and that includes indirect. So we have all tipped employees, and the 941 has all wages and all tips. And the wage figure is for all the employees of that particular establishment. So we don't capture that data at the IRS.
Is there anything in federal law that provides guidance to employers on tipping out?
Go ahead, if you want.
Senator Nelson, Senator Breyer, there is. In fact, the guidance is clear, direct, and it says that non-directly tipped employees, like cooks, dishwashers, tipped employees cannot be mandated to share tips with those people.
So that's federal law?
That's federal law.
Does that include, like, bus people and...
Those are indirectly tipped employees. There's a difference between a non-tipped employee and an indirectly tipped employee. An indirectly tipped employee might be a bartender or a bus person. Those would be the two most common examples. I want to make a statement here. Tip out is irrelevant as it relates to this bill. Because, again, this bill only applies to tips reported by the employee to their employer. So if they didn't receive them, they're not going to be, and if they didn't keep them, they're not going to be reporting them. So the tip out equation is really incidental and inconsequential as it relates to this bill.
The only federal requirement, Senator, on tip outs is that they keep track of who they tip out to, and they report their net tip. Because the indirectly tipped employee is to report their tips as well. They're required by law because it's income to them as well. Okay. I wanted to add that nationwide, since the program started, we have 9,300 track agreements representing 31,000 restaurants nationwide. We have 1,170 TRDA agreements representing 2,500 gaming and hair salon establishments. And in Oregon, we have over 550 employers on track and TRDA agreements representing 1,300 establishments. The employers entered the track agreement for three reasons. Number one, they don't want an unexpected tax liability on the employer's share of FICA tax that will be assessed to them. And I'll wrap this up really quick. Number two, there's an employer credit available nationwide, federal credit, tax credit, and they want to be in compliance with the tax law. And I want to say that we are educating the Pacific Northwest District employers as fast as we can. The track program is an optional program, and if they choose not to go on it, doesn't mean it's an automatic audit. The audits are based on egregious noncompliance. So I have to emphasize, and I can't say it enough, that the track program is optional, and it's well received. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Doctor.
Senator Nelson, members of the committee, thank you for inviting me today. My name is Jim Turborg. I'm a professor of management in the Lunkus College of Business at the University of Oregon. My PhD is in a field called Industrial Organizational Psychology from Purdue University in 1975. I've been here since 1980. I was involved in a survey of restaurant owners and managers in Oregon. I was contacted by the Oregon Restaurant Association and asked to participate in conducting the survey. And what I've given you is a three-page executive summary of the survey plus some additional data on employment trends. The complete results of the report that I gave to the Oregon Restaurant Association, I don't have copies here. I'm sure they can make it available to you if you wish, but it's about 25, 30 pages long.
That would be very good. If you could speak from the heart, that would be very good.
Okay.
Rather than reading it.
We sent a survey to 1,000 restaurant owners and managers. This was randomly selected. It was a stratified random sample based on membership lists of the Oregon Restaurant Association and non-members. This was one of the questions of the surveys is, do you have an appropriate sample? I believe we do. I've been criticized by some colleagues at the university who testified to the House committee after I did. And they made, I think, some general criticisms about survey methodology that could be applied more or less to any survey. In my opinion, they did not provide any specific empirical data that would question the validity of this survey. And they also ignored some data that I think support the validity.
Yes, Senator Barr.
Just a question, because I know the industry has a really broad representation. Are we looking here at primarily restaurants, or does this include bars?
It would include bars, although minimally it would be, this is in the final, in the report, 47% were identified as family casual restaurants, 21% fast food quick service, 5% pub bar tavern, 13% fine dining, 1% buffet style, 1% contract food service, and 12% just marked other. This was a self-report based on what the restaurant managers and owners gave us.
Which percentage was the family?
I'm sorry?
You used the category of family. Was family restaurant?
It's called family casual. That was 47%.
Okay. And fine dining?
13%.
Okay.
This is based on 204 respondents. We received back 207 surveys from the 1,000 that were mailed. A few came back that were inappropriate because the restaurants had gone out of business or they said they were not a restaurant. Response rate was 21%. If you were to look at the page 3 of the material I gave you, this compares survey respondents to what I'm calling the population of restaurants. This was the list of Oregon Restaurant Association members and non-members that I had. When I contacted various agencies in the state government, county governments about getting a list of restaurants in state and county, they said they didn't really have good measures of those and told me to contact the Oregon Restaurant Association because they had the best list. Again, it was a random sample. If we compare the geographical representation of the sample with the population and apply statistical tests to this, it suggests that that there is no bias in terms of at least the geographical area. family data analysis and a 207 completed surveys. The actual survey, some of the items vary by the sample size because of various characteristics. For example, some questions we ask about if you have TIP eligible employees. So those restaurants that did not wouldn't have answered those questions. Some items were also left blank. We applied, again, the standard research methodology. To just highlight the results and then talk about some of the economic data and do this in about 3 minutes. We found that increases in the minimum wage did benefit some employees, those at the lowest levels. Obviously, those at the minimum wage had their wages increased. Those that were near but just above the minimum wage also seemed to have their wages increased at almost about exactly 50 cents an hour. But those employees who were further away from the minimum wage, it was reported that increasing wages to minimum wage and those just near the minimum wage made it more difficult to pass on increases to those further away from the minimum wage. So we're looking at trade-offs here of the impact of the minimum wage policy in Oregon. And I think much of the results here from the perspective of the restaurant owners and managers highlights what some of those trade-offs are. Higher minimum wage results in, according to the most common listed areas, higher menu prices, reduced employee hours, and reduced number of employees. So those are the three most commonly listed. If we look at the pages 4 and 5 and those charts that are on those pages, one of the questions would be is how can 60 or 70% of the restaurants say that they're reducing the number of employees when employment growth in the restaurant industry has increased from year to year? There's a variety of ways to explain this. One is that the data that we collected were at the level of the restaurant, not at the level of individual employees. Let me give you an example. Suppose we have 10 restaurants, 6 restaurants that are all very small, say we intend to or we've laid off one employee each. 2 restaurants say they're not making any changes, and 2 restaurants that may be large say we intend to hire 1 restaurant 3 people, 1 restaurant 4 people. So 60% of the restaurants reduce their number of employees, 20% increase, but they increase, added 7 employees, 6 restaurants reduce 1 each, so the net gain could be 1 employee in terms of employment levels.
That could be the result, and they all were subject to only knowing their own marketplace. Could be the subject, to some extent, the smaller family-owned restaurants being pushed out of businesses by chain
I can't really address that. The survey wasn't asking those kinds of questions. If you look at the complete survey, there were some breakdowns of seeing if the effects seem to be stronger or more pronounced in smaller restaurants than others. I would encourage you to get the final report and to read the comments. We had a comment section that people wanted to make those, and they run the full range from support of minimum wage to saying that this is basically driving us out of business.
Did you score the profit margins at all?
We did have questions in the complete survey. Do you want me to try to find it now, or
do you have an inclination that they? I assume that that's one of the reasons the employment dropped was because profit margins are dropping.
We didn't ask that question particularly. I'm trying to find it. It was what we did look at was the total payroll cost as a percent of revenue. And 88%.
Comment on that, Mike?
Well, Senator Nelson, Senator Breyer, average profit margin in the restaurant industry is about 3.5%.
Has it gone down?
It's remained somewhat the same. Impact on profits, we think, will frankly probably happen this year. This is the year of the dramatic increase to $6.50. The other wages, I think we adjusted to in some regard.
Okay. Well, again, what have restaurants been doing? They say increased prices, reduced hours, reduced number of employees. I don't have data on changes in increased prices. I tried to collect data on the number of hours that's currently not kept by the state. I can't find anyone who provide me those data. What I did do is I looked at employment growth in Oregon and Washington for the two-year period prior to 1997 when the minimum wage took effect, the first hike, and from January 97 to 99, And if I won't go into detail, but if you look at the charts on pages 4 and 5 of the handout, what it shows is that prior to 1997, from employment growth as a percent of population growth in eating and drinking in Oregon was among the fastest growing areas in the state. And if you look at the trends from January 97 to January 99, employment growth overall has slowed down. It slowed down most pronounced in manufacturing and in eating and drinking. I think the a plausible explanation for why it dropped in manufacturing is what's happening with Asia and the number of exports that we have. The drop in eating and drinking kind of begs, what was the question, what was happening. We don't find the same kind of drop in total non-farm or in manufacturing or in hotel and lodging. If you look at the data for the state of Washington, the results are almost the exact opposite. They show that there's been a stronger increase in employment in eating and drinking. The last page shows minimum wage in Oregon and Washington from 94 to 99. And the minimum wage in Washington was $4.90, I believe, until January of 1999. So we would not expect to see pronounced employment effects yet in the January 1999 data. What we also find out, as Mike had said, is that waiters and waitresses are most likely to have their hours and positions cut. That we're finding longer hours for salaried employees, for shift supervisors and head cooks as a way to address this. We're seeing, depending on how you want to look at it, less opportunity for full-time jobs and less opportunity for jobs for minors, or more opportunity for part-time jobs and more opportunity for jobs for those who are above the age of 18. Respondents said that restaurants avoid opening in Oregon because of this and that there are more restaurant failures. Again, I tried to identify data that would look at restaurant startups and failures, and no one's been able to tell me where I can find those data yet, and I've made numerous calls. Lastly, we asked if the tip wage were available and a training wage were available, would you use this? And of those restaurants that have tip-eligible employees, 86% said they would use a tip wage. And as a result of that, they said they most likely changes would be an increase in the number of hours worked, an increase in the number of tipped employees that they use, an increase in the level of employee benefits, and a decrease in menu prices. And asked if they would use a training wage for minors if it were available, and this was only one question in the survey, 66% said that they would use a training wage for minors if it were available. So again, I'm here to comment on the results of the survey, but not specifically on aspects of the bill.
Senator Beyer.
Doctor, in that last question, did you ask them if they were using the federal tax credit?
No, I did not.
You happen to know?
No, I don't.
Oh, that was a question. Yeah, right?
I don't have that
data. That's very substantial, if I recall. Right?
Senator Nelson, Senator Beyer, again, the federal tax credit applies to the amount of taxes paid to the federal government on tip income, and it is available. It's underutilized, very underutilized, and there is no state tax credits available, and there is no address either for workers' compensation paid on tips. So, on one hand, fair wages, on the other hand, they're not.
Well, Rossi said, looked at that, and I know they changed the federal programs, but it used to be for youth they could get a 50% tax credit against wages paid. Is that changed?
Senator Nelson, Senator Beyer, I am not aware of any tax credits for youth employment.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony.
And
yes.
Yes. Sure.
Yes. One thing I have a question here.
One question. For Professor Cherbourg.
Yes.
Are you familiar with Gordon Laffer and Stephen Johnson?
Yes.
Have you seen their analysis of your report?
Yes.
Have you created some response to their analysis?
Well, I think what I said earlier is they made many general comments that were criticisms of surveys, but didn't provide anything that specifically said the results of this survey were biased. They ignored the results that I provided showing it was a representative sample, at least in terms of the geographic area, and they ignored the data on the economic trends. Now, if the economic trends in Oregon were actually the same as those of Washington, then the survey would be discredited, I think, because how can we find that the rate of job growth in eating and drinking is increasing at such a faster rate when the survey results are incompatible with that? And what I would like to suggest is that the data in terms of employment growth are consistent with what the survey results are telling us. I'd also like to say that I did comment to Gordon Laffer, sent him an email message back asking him for some comments back, and he's never replied. They also used a cited a criticism of the, they said that there's some other surveys that suggest the minimum wage does not have an effect on employment, but they did not, as far as I can tell, cite the original source. They cited a small column out of Business Week, and the Business Week article said one of the strengths of this survey, the survey that they were citing, was that they surveyed employers. So they're using a survey to support their position, and they're criticizing this survey for the exact same reason.
I recognize that Mr. Laffer is from the Labor Education Research Center in the Department of Political Science, and having graduated in that area from that university, I'm certain that he wouldn't have a bias.
Thank you
very much. Philip, Joy Marshall, Helen Lowell, Senator Castillo, would you like to come and speak? Okay. Oh, just had him. Please come in, Representative. Yes. Excuse me, I couldn't see you back there. You got to holler a little louder. One of the things we do is that members of the Senate or the House come in there, and they have other committees, so we do give them preference. Senator Castillo, please introduce yourself.
Thank you.
I know you'll all speak from the heart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Susan Castillo, State Senator from Eugene District 20. I come before you to oppose any attempt to alter the minimum wage. When voters said yes to increasing the minimum wage in this state, they did not say just do it for some employees in our state. They said please do this for all minimum wage workers. And this bill is an attempt to deny that to some of our employees. And I know that the supporters continue to say that this is not a minimum wage bill, but if you will look at the relating clause here, it says relating to minimum wage on the bill. We have had a number of new restaurants open up in the Eugene-Lane County area since the minimum wage was passed, minimum wage increase was passed. Recently, there was one restaurant that closed, and it was a perfect opportunity for that restaurant owner to lodge a complaint about our minimum wage increases. And instead, and rather than say anything about minimum wage, the reason for closing was that there were so many new restaurants opening in our area that there was just a lot more competition for the customer. And it seemed to me that that was a perfect opportunity. If this was so onerous for restaurants in our area, that would have been cited in that case. But I just very much support and want to honor what people said when they went to the ballot and supported our increases in minimum wage. And I see that this bill is an attempt to not carry out what the voters have said they want us to do. So, thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator. Representative.
Thank you, Chairman Nelson, members of the committee. I am Diane Rosenbaum, State Representative from House District 14 in Portland, and I'm here today to testify in opposition to House Bill 2793, and I also served as the chair of the Minimum Wage Coalition, which put Measure 36 on the ballot in 1996, and so I'm also speaking in that capacity. There are many, many reasons that I think you should oppose this bill, including the fact that it singles out some of the most vulnerable populations of workers, among them farm workers, young people, and particularly women. And I think one thing that needs to be pointed out is that the vast majority of minimum wage workers, two-thirds in fact, are women. And in the restaurant industry in particular, the figures even higher. Employment Division figures show us that 87% of those workers are women. And 36% of all minimum wage workers are actually sole supporters for themselves and their entire household. A study that I think you'll hear more about from other witnesses done at the University of Washington recently showed that for a single person in the state of Oregon, it takes $10.07 an hour for a single person supporting themselves only to be above the level where they qualify for public assistance. And the figure for someone supporting an adult and two children is actually $16.36 an hour. That's just not to qualify for food stamps or for the Oregon Health Plan. So these really are not high-wage jobs that we're talking about at any level. And I think there are aspects of the bill that create problems not just for workers but for employers. And specifically, I would ask you to think about the setting up of a two-tier wage system where the only difference between two people doing identical work is how old they are, or the fact that one was hired before January 1st of next year and one was hired after can set up significant equity problems. But primarily what I want to talk to you about today is the aspect of this that will have an effect, I believe, on the 770,000 people who voted in favor of ballot measure 36 when it was on the ballot in 1996. And I know legislators sometimes get tired of hearing this will of the voters stuff because we hear it a lot, but I think in the case of this bill, there are some things that are pretty unique that we really do need to think hard about. First, I'd ask you to consider that the only reason there was a ballot measure was because a bill that Senator Gordley, at the time Representative Gordley, introduced in the 95 legislative session failed to get even a single hearing. And so people who were seeking to revisit a minimum wage that hadn't gone up since 1991 really were left with no recourse but to put something on the ballot or simply to wait and see if there would be a chance to get a hearing in the future. So it was something that came about with a lot of thought. And it was not done, as many ballot measures these days are, as a constitutional amendment. And that is something that was considered, too. But in fact, all it did was make a statutory change to the dollar amounts in the minimum wage law. And I think the message, by revisiting something that has so recently taken effect to voters, is a very, very dangerous one, and that is to suggest that things need to be put in the Constitution or that legislatures may revisit what has just been passed by the voters. And I think that is something to think very hard about for those of us who, like many of us, think the Constitution is being too easily amended as it is now. I also would ask you to think about the fact that I'm sure you all heard from voters in your campaigns the same thing I did, which is that people often feel that their vote doesn't count, and that that's because they see something that they passed being revisited, often reversed by legislators almost immediately on passage. And in fact, the last thing I'd ask you to consider is what the bill is doing, because the very most common categories of workers who were talked about were featured in discussions both pro and con on raising the minimum wage were in fact women restaurant workers, typically the people that this bill would affect. And these are not new arguments. They are the arguments that the opponents were making in 1995 about the effect on restaurants, about the effect on young people. And today, as you heard in the previous panel, we're still waiting to see these effects. It always seems to be off just the next step in the future where we're about to see the effects of massive unemployment. So for all of those reasons, I would urge you to take a very cautious approach to this bill and ultimately to reject it. And one more comment I'd make for your consideration is I think it is really, really important for people who are affected by this bill to be allowed an ample opportunity to testify. I would hate to think that people would show up here in Salem once again and when their wages are the topic not be allowed to be heard either in support or in opposition of the bill, and so I would ask you to allow ample time for that testimony to take place.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dan Gardner, State Representative from House District 13 in Portland, and I'm here today, as I'm sure will surprise you, in opposition to the bill. I serve on the House Business and Consumer Affairs Committee that heard this bill on the House side, and just want to make a few quick comments. I personally feel a lot of the argument here is that it's going to increase hours for wait staff if this bill were passed, and I have to tell you, I personally feel that's a rather ridiculous argument. I worked in the restaurant industry some 20 years ago in what seems like another life. But anyway, what they always keep is the wait staff at a very, very tight margin to meet the client's health needs, and I don't believe that restaurants will automatically put more people on unless it meets the clientele's need. They won't cut people that much either because people will not be served and the business will suffer. It's always a battle to keep that margin tight, and a very smart business keeps that margin very, very tight. So I don't believe those will increase any hours whatsoever. They also talk about it being a back-of-the-house versus front-of-the-house argument. I just want to point out to you on the House side, I offered an amendment to take any savings created by this bill from the tipped employees and give it to the non-tipped employees, and that was soundly rejected. And my understanding at the time was because it was not supported by the Restaurant Association. The other thing that I'd point out to you is that they also make a lot of arguments about our having the highest minimum wage in the nation. I'd point out to you that in the last election cycle, 1998, the state of Washington passed a minimum wage, increasing it to $6.50 an hour, and also attached it to the CPI for automatic wage increases, so that they will continue to outrank us in minimum wage unless we see fit to add it to the CPI. And with that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think I'll just leave it at that. I have some constituents to meet upstairs.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate your time. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator. My name is Joy Marshall. I'm a community organizer in Lane County, and I've been so for 9 years, and I'm currently adjunct staff at the Labor Education and Research Center. And I'm really here today to point out to you some of the testimony that I guess you've been looking at. And I'm sorry Senator Miller isn't here to hear me maybe explain some of the testimony. Perhaps some of this can be passed on to him. And I'm really here today to express the concern of three university colleagues that a major policy decision might be made based on this study, on Professor Cherbourg's study. And this study is seriously flawed. It is not a scientific study, and it would provide completely inappropriate grounds. If we are going to base overturning the new higher minimum wage, if we're going to base that on this study, it would be a serious mistake. And the professor said, well, yes, he was familiar with these criticisms and didn't feel that there was any substantive reason given for doubting the survey, and that's really not the case. And I don't want to read too much of this testimony because you do have it written before you, but the testimony from Steve Johnson, who is the Associate Director of the University of Oregon Survey Research Laboratory, and he conducts numerous surveys a year. He teaches research methods and statistics, and he says this is a seriously flawed non-scientific study. One of the main causes, and this is a very specific scientific reason, despite what the professor just said, is that it has an extremely low response rate. And to be scientific, you have to have a response rate 3 to 4 times higher than they got. In other words, there's no guarantee it wasn't a vocal minority who was responding. There's no guarantee of that whatsoever. And the scientific position is that a study with that kind of response rate cannot be said to accurately represent the population from which it is drawn. And you cannot draw valid conclusions from this study. The other major problem that Dr. Johnson points out is that it does not make clear that this information is people's opinions and attitudes. There's no hard data in the study. It's people's opinions. Well, yes, I don't like the higher minimum wage, or I will be cutting back hours. And yet this kind of data is available. And it's also years of research on public opinion and human decision making give a variety of reasons why opinions rarely represent facts. This may be limitations on memory, bias toward reporting, what it thought to be the result the researcher wants to hear, difficulty in making numeric judgments, a tendency to generalize from one's most recent experience to all past experiences. In other words, as well-intended as these responses might be, they were opinions, and study has shown that opinions do not reflect what really happened. So I think that there is definitely substantive scientific reason for doubting this study. Two other professors, the political science professor, Gordon Lafer, that Senator Miller referred to, also does indeed give a substantive reason for not basing important decisions on the study. It is disturbing that the Restaurant Association's report studiously ignores every data source and instead bases its analysis exclusively on a survey of owners' perceptions. Second, even ignoring other data sources, the ORA study itself does not contain a single hard number. So I think it's important that that we take this study for what it is, and it's not that it's
completely useless, but certainly it is not any kind of scientific data. There is no kind of data in that study. And if we're going to do something as serious as cutting back half of the new minimum wage to approximately half of those receiving minimum wage, six employees and youth, we better make sure we're basing it on hard science. And the study is not that. Dr. Margaret Halleck, who is an economics professor and is the director of the Labor Education and Research Center, who I do not have copies of her study, and I will get that to you. Her analysis is similar, but she goes more into depth about the minimum wage. The flaws in the Restaurant Association study are all the more dramatic when one considers the large body of research they could have consulted but chose to ignore. And then Professor Cherbourg has said, well, gee, they didn't quote them. Well, when you see this, and this was also turned in to the House committee when they heard this bill, and I believe the professor did see this, it does have the exact sources of these studies. So those sources are stated, are cited. The minimum wage, let me see. Recent studies confirm the findings that increases in the minimum wage have not had significant employment effects in general, nor for specific groups of workers, including young workers. We're not trying to say this is a free lunch, but clearly if you want to look at science and data, which I would hope that's what we're going to base this on, the alternative is much worse. The alternative of not having minimum wage keep up with inflation, the alternative of taking $1,000 to $2,000 per year income away from low-income workers, that alternative is much worse. The minimum wage, this is again quoting Dr. Halleck, is a critical public policy issue for hundreds of thousands of Oregonians because people at minimum wage and just above will all be greatly affected by the decision this committee makes. It deserves to be afforded the most rigorous and most critical analysis, focusing on all sides of the question and drawing on the most reliable sources of information available. Unfortunately, Professor Cherbourg's study does not meet these standards, so I don't think I need to belabor this point. Again, it's an opinion poll, and it's worth looking at from that regard. It is definitely insufficient grounds to overturn the popular 1996 ballot measure. And I'm going to put on my other hat here quickly because for 9 years I've been a community organizer in Lane County, and I've talked to all kinds of small business owners and restaurant workers and other folks of all walks of life. And there is that sense that their vote doesn't count. And people have been saying to me, why are they considering overturning this 1996 measure? And my feeling is that the PAC that gave the most campaign contributions in the last election cycle is trying to come in and have wages lowered for their particular class of employees. And that's not something I enjoy telling the voters in Oregon. And I hope I don't have to do that. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Enjoy.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Ellen Lowe. I direct public policy for Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. We're a voluntary association of 16 Christian denominations. There are about 1,200 congregations statewide that are part of those denominations. First of all, I will be distributing to you a letter from Bud Clark, who is associated with Goose Hollow Inn in Portland, in which he expresses his reservations about this House bill and his concluding sentences. Currently, restaurants in Oregon compete on a level playing field. Let's keep it that way. And I will distribute that to you when I have completed my testimony. I have some history with the minimum wage in Oregon, in that one of the first tasks that I was assigned when I went to work part-time for Ecumenical Ministries in 1986 was really looking at what was happening to Oregonians in terms of being able to meet their basic needs. And that led to some research with food pantries and food banks across the state. And what we discovered was that when people came to food banks, it was often after the second week of the month and at the conclusion of the month. And we were seeing working Oregonians. We were seeing the working poor who were unable to make it on their salaries. So in 1988, there was a group of us that began to meet. And we used to meet because so many of us had conflicts on other days at 7 a.m. on Monday mornings. And we met for about a year in crafting a piece of legislation which was adopted by the 1989 Oregon legislature that at that time led to the highest minimum wage in the country. And in crafting that bill, we reviewed the issues that are before you today. We talked about tip credit. We talked about having some exceptions for farm workers. We talked about training wage. And our conclusion was that what we really needed to do, rather than having tiered systems, was to adopt, and for us, it was a proposal that became part of Senate Bill 335, because that was the current minimum wage, that would be a minimum. And so there wouldn't be a tiered system. And that was adopted by this body then in 1989 and signed by the governor. Now, as has been mentioned to you by Representative Rosenbaum, there were attempts then in 95 to begin to look at the minimum wage again, and that was unsuccessful. So once again, those of us who were involved in looking at economic justice really came together and looked at crafting the bill. Our conclusion was the same, that it needed to be a minimum, because if we had really looked at what was a living wage, it would have been at least $10 an hour if we were looking at a single person. And so we rejected that and went with what we considered a minimum, so there wouldn't be a two-tiered system. Raising the minimum wage was really the right thing to do in terms of economic and social justice. And in doing that, really Oregonians made a promise to at least begin to look at justice for the working poor. And so it would be our judgment that if indeed we renege on what the voters, and there were over 700,000 of them, what they said they wanted in 1996, that we really would be reneging on that promise for economic and social justice. And I would suggest that maybe a review of what is said by the prophets, and particularly Micah, where he talks about pursuing justice, or even Jeremiah, where it's he writes, "Woe to him who makes his neighbor serve him for nothing and does not give him his wages." Oregonians really did vote again for economic and social justice when they voted for Measure 36. They voted for a minimum that was a minimum, not a tiered system. And so we sincerely hope that you will not go back on the commitments that the voters made to, again, the people at the very bottom of the scale. And I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Any questions for this panel?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Sandra Henson, Ramon Ramirez, Tiffany Bowers.
Well, I'm waiting for them to come up here. Maybe I'll give you these. This is 1,700 more signatures of Oregonians.
Please introduce yourself.
3,300, Shirley Ann.
Yes, please introduce yourself.
My name is Sandra Henson, and I'm from Yaha.
We're fairly short of time, so if you could...
Oh, go ahead, if that's all right with you.
Yes, please, and connect your points down, if you could, please.
I certainly will. Good afternoon, fellow Oregonians. The Oregon Health Plan, food stamps, welfare, assisted child care, and House Bill 2793. What do all these things have in common? They're all subsidy programs. The only difference is that in the case of House Bill 2793, the public funds come directly out of the pockets of restaurant customers. Since this last increase in the minimum wage, four people where I work have gotten off all subsidy programs, saving money for each and every Oregonian. Plus, when people make more, they pay more taxes. With more taxes being paid to the state and less money being paid out in subsidies, I believe Oregonians created a win-win situation when they cast negative.
Are you reading from this from testimony?
No, my testimony that I have submitted is not the same.
I'm going to have to limit your time just because we're very
absolutely
short. We have another committee coming in here. I want to give you an opportunity to do that, so if you would just please summarize.
Okay, I will. You've heard about how many jobs have been created in Oregon since the minimum wage bill has been passed, and that's over 4,000. You've also heard, I think, about the Outback Steakhouse. This NASDAQ-listed chain opened in Oregon 7 restaurants in 1998. They knew there was no tip credit here, as they knew there was no tip credit in Washington and California, where they also opened restaurants. I don't think they would have opened if they didn't think they could make a profit. They've already adjusted their prices by $1 in Salem and $2 more in Bend and Portland. I called all 7 of them. They're all taking applications, and they are all hiring. The one I queried about open time, oh, 3 are hiring, excuse me. The one I queried about open time informed me that they were only open 44 hours a week. That's one shift of people. It's hard to lay off people or cut back hours when you only have one shift.
Okay, now, what is it now?
On their website.
May I please ask you just get to the point?
Okay. On their website, they also list their net income as over $92 million. And I think it's ironic that we're sitting here talking about subsidizing restaurant owners when the Commerce Department of the United States of America has designated 1999 the year of the restaurant. I wanted to ask Mr. McClellan what the Oregon Restaurant Association is doing to promote that. And I urge you to uphold the vote of Oregonians and vote no on House Bill 2793.
Thank you very much. Please introduce yourself. And I apologize. We're just under some time constraints. And
this is quick. Okay. Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Tiffany Bowers, and I'm here on behalf of OSA and COSAC, which is Community College Association. And I'm a senior at Western Oregon University. I am a resident of Monmouth. And I've been a waitress for 5 years. To give you a quick cap, I started working when I was 15, and my parents don't help me out with college. The total educational costs are upon my shoulders. I guess in sum to say, I paid $15,000 to Western Oregon University because I can wait tables. In sum. I can tell you from the heart that without the ability to wait tables, there's no way I can graduate. There's not a single way. I don't qualify for financial aid. My scholarships don't cover it enough. Point blank. And I'm not the only person who's out there waiting tables who's going to college. And I guess the second step to my testimony would be that if I can't graduate, where am I stuck at? What am I going to do? I almost have a bachelor's. I'm close. I'm not qualified to do anything just yet. And I can't go on and get a master's either. So I guess what I would plead my case to the committee before me today is that if you deny people the ability to make a living, to try and better themselves, and to contribute to this Oregon economy, how many people are you losing who could actually contribute? That's all I have to say. Thanks for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you very much. Introduce yourself.
Thank you. My name is Ramon Ramirez, for the record. I'm president of the Oregon Farm Worker Union, PECUN, and you have my testimony there, so you know I won't go into that, but I just want to make a couple of points really brief in that I think, I'm here to oppose House Bill 2793. I think it'll have a adverse effect on farm workers. The bill is a farm worker bill, the provisions in it. I just want to clarify that. After careful examination of the bill, this was a question raised on the House side whether it was a farm worker bill or not. And I think everybody now agrees that it is a farm worker bill and that it would have an adverse effect on farm workers. I think the bill is an attack on farm workers. The average income of farm workers in the state of Oregon is about $7,500 a year. So we're talking about the people that put the food on the table of American people are getting shortchanged. I mean, I can go into a lot of statistics about that, the housing, the living and working conditions of farm workers. But I think, you know, one of the things that is happening is that, you know, the other provisions of the bill will have a great effect on our youth also. For example, a lot of the youth, farm worker youth are you know, between 16 and 17 years old are really productive workers. They don't work for photo money or to go, you know, go to movies and stuff. They help support their families. So we're talking about if you cut farm worker youth wages, it'll have a tremendous effect. One last point is that I think this bill would have a tremendous effect on farm worker families that are trying to legalize their immigration status. Currently, the U.S. Government has raised the bar in terms of how much money you need to make to become a legalized resident in this country. For example, there's a 125% increase. So a family of four last year would have to have made $16,000 a year to qualify for immigration status. This year, it's jumped to over $21,000. So on one hand, you have the federal government raising the bar in terms of how much you can make, you know, to work here and live here legally. On the other hand, we're seeing attempts by the legislature to lower the minimum wage that would have a tremendous effect, right? And if you factor in that when you apply for legal status in this country, you can use your family's wages, those that are, you know, 16, 17, 18 years old, to get immigration status, and you eliminate their ability to earn minimum wage, well, in essence, what you're doing is creating illegal immigration in the state. And so I'll stop here. I just really think that this bill has far-reaching effects than the facts that we've heard. Representative Diane Rosenbaum pointed out, you know, we need to take a critical look at this bill before we make a decision. And I urge the committee in the end to oppose it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? We have actually four more witnesses here.
Mr. Chair, can I ask one real quick question?
Sure.
Just real quickly, I know we're all up against here. Mr. Ramirez, just one question about the farm workers. If the farm workers were removed from this bill, would you be content with it?
No, I wouldn't because, a lot of the Latino community in the state are restaurant workers, are waiters and waitresses. And they fall on their, you know, for Latinos, you know, if you look at the income that the Latino community makes, right, we're far below the rest of the general population. So we would, our community stands in unity with our brothers and sisters in the restaurant industry who are struggling to make a decent wage. So we would oppose this bill, even if the farm worker provisions were stripped out.
Thank you very much. Robert Whitten, Sean Getsky, Aaron Broderick, and Heidi Schwartz, if you could all come up. Please start, introduce yourself, and speak from the heart if you could, please. I remember all the time.
My name is Aaron Broderick. I'm a waiter and slash bartender at the Wild Duck Brewery in Eugene. Thanks for the chance to share my view of House Bill 2793. I support the bill because it makes sense. As a waiter bartender, my wage with tips averages $15 to $20 an hour, while my counterparts in the kitchen make anywhere from $6.50 to $8.50 an hour. For me to get another raise while their wage stays where it is silly. But to freeze their wage at $6.50, which is one of the highest wages for tipped employees in the nation, makes sense. I'll still make good money, and it would free up money to pay the cooks and chefs more. Passage of this bill would also give the executive chefs where I work more leverage to hire experienced chefs because the experienced chefs demand more of a wage than $1 or $2 above the minimum wage. And in a roundabout way, the experience of these chefs would help line my pockets as the patrons would tip better for food that they're impressed with. And I know we're short on time, so I'll finish up by saying it's not like I'm taking a pay cut. I still make $6.50 an hour plus tips, which is what I rely on mainly for income, more than my hourly wage. I support a better balance between the two essential components of a restaurant, the front and the back of the house. One side can't function without the other, so one has a little bit of a better balance between their wages. That's about it.
Thank you very much. Please introduce yourself, and if you can do the same.
My name is Sean Jeffke. I'm the executive chef of the Wild Duck Restaurant in Eugene, Oregon. I have approximately 25 people, including myself, who this issue directly affects. Due to the fact that the highest paid employees, the servers, have all received raises in the form of minimum wage increases, there's no money left in the labor pool for kitchen employees. None of my employees earn more than $8.50 per hour. In fact, 90% of them earn less than $8 per hour. That's $1.50 to $2 less than what is considered to be a livable wage, while servers make an average of $20, including wage and tip. That's $12 to $13 less, or more than what the cooks are making. Try explaining to a cook with 15 to 20 years of experience or a $15,000 to $20,000 culinary degree why you can only pay them $2 more per hour than your dishwasher. I'm unable to hold on to valuable qualified employees because they're looking for higher wages. I'm a young restaurant and unable to be competitive with more established restaurants. Plus the cost of training them and then to have them leave for a higher paying job is a double whammy in terms of cost. The quality of employee I can afford is very marginal. The constant turnover results in a lack of consistency and a cohesion among staff, which opens up an ugly can of worms. Furthermore, resulting in tension between the front of the house and the back of the house, as well as the back of the house to the back of the house. The dishwashers and the cooks have frustrations with each other because the cooks are only making $1 more an hour with their 15 years of experience. The dishwashers making minimum wage of $6.50 with no experience. which seriously inhibits our ability to maintain a team atmosphere, which is imperative in our industry. I can't afford to hire young, inexperienced kids because labor dollars are very tight, and I have to get maximum productivity from the outset. It's really a shame not to be able to provide opportunities for our youth, and now the youth are learning an unfair lesson about economics. I'm a salaried employee. Efforts to minimize labor result in increased workload, longer hours, more stress, less sleep, and there's still no money left in the pool for raises. As the servers and bartenders continue to prosper, the kitchen staff receives minimal compensation. It is not equitable. Addressing the issue of what owners will do with the so-called extra money from a tip credit. If owners do not put the money back into the business, if they put the money into their pocket, good cooks quit, servers make less than tips, quality of food slips, people stop coming to the restaurant, owner goes out of business. The restaurant's profit margin is not so great that there is extra money to just give people raises. The owners of the Wild Duck Restaurant would invite you to look at their books and see for yourself how this issue affects us as well as other Oregon restaurants. There is no extra money. If the money generated from a tip credit does not go back into the company, then everybody loses, from the dishwashers, cooks, servers, and the owners. Thank you very much for your time and consideration.
Thank you very much, sir.
Senator Nelson, Peace Committee, my name is Robert Whitman. I represent the largest food and beverage operation on the Oregon coast, Chinook Winds Casino. I did not come to this decision to support this bill lightly. I did quite a bit of extensive research, which I'll give to the clerk when I leave for you to look at. My prepared testimony is in here as well. I will not go into that. I'd only like to answer some of the questions that were raised here. My labor costs have gone up 8.9%. My wait staff has gone down 5.7%. I had to do this to meet the budget that my casino puts on me to make a profit. My profit is 2%. And so far this year I haven't hit my profit, so my owners are on my case. The lady from the college, I missed her name, asked a question about hard data. There are studies in here by the EPI Institute in Washington, D.C. on the effects of Oregon's minimum wage, Washington's minimum wage, who is a minimum wage earner. Just one number that comes out, the study that Dr. David McPherson did, is that 5,400 employees will not be hired or lose their jobs in the next year based on the Oregon minimum wage. 49% of them will be in the food and beverage area. Senator Castillo mentioned that so many restaurants open in Eugene. I can't speak for Eugene, but I can speak for the Oregon coast. 3 restaurants have closed, 2 have downsized. 2 of the ones that have closed cited the cost of doing business as the reason they closed. One was a poor manager. He would have closed anyhow. Another one downsized just to try to make cost meet. We are a large employer. We intend to be an employer of choice. We represent the most of the large employers in the food and beverage operation. We will compress wages up. In other words, if the minimum wage goes up 8%, as we go up the scale of higher paid employees, we will, as they come due for raises, give them a raise. We can afford to do that. The small restaurants can't. The rest of what I have to say is in here, and I'll be more than happy to give you a question for you to look at later.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. My name is Heidi Schwartz. Excuse me, my voice is going to shake a little bit. I work for the Outback Steakhouse in Beaverton, Oregon. I'm a bartender and a server. I can tell you over the past year of watching, I love the fact that I'm paid $6.50 an hour. I think it's great because when I first moved here, I was totally blown away by the fact I was just making $2.52 an hour. I can tell you two major things that I see from this. The biggest thing is the kitchen staff, and I call it my kitchen staff because they're my bread and butter. If the food doesn't go out right, I'm not making the tips that I should be making because something's wrong. It's a very big team effort in the restaurant business. The front of the house and the back of the house need to be like this because communication-wise, everything comes down to our food. And I can tell you just in my restaurant alone, I've seen the difference it makes where I know of several cooks that are going to the culinary school that are working two jobs because they are not allowed, there's no money for them to be paid at least $10 an hour. You know, it's not, and my personal, what I make is between $15 to $20 an hour, including my minimum wage. And my checks, I don't count on. My $6.50 an hour, I don't count on. I don't see any of it. It all goes to the IRS because every single one of my tips is claimed. I don't see any of it. I can work 52 hours in 2 weeks, and my paycheck is about $50. That's not a lot of money. I would rather see that extra dollar go to the kitchen where it's going to make a difference for everybody. Everybody in the restaurant business going down from dishwashers to chefs to our kitchen managers, to our assistant kitchen managers. It is so imperative that this bill passes because with this risk, you as customers, as our guests, are going to suffer because we can't give you that excellent service that I uphold, or I try to uphold. And I thank you for your time very much, and I hope you approve this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and I thank everybody for taking the time. I'm sorry that we were under some time constraints. We'll close the public hearing and close the committee hearing. Thank you very much. Well, we got through it.
Thank you.
Wipe it down. Go ahead, Rebecca. Just wipe it down.
Coming out here. That note was for you.